free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It's Friday, June 13th, 2014. And I'm very glad to welcome to the program today Alejandro Chafuen, who is president of the Atlas Economic Research Foundation, a position he's held since 1991. But in particular, I want to talk to him about a book of his that has been very important to me, and that's a book that began in 1986 called, with the title, Christians for Freedom, Late Scholastic Economics, and then in 2003, an expanded edition was called Faith and Liberty, the Economic Thought of the Late Scholastics. Now, who are the late scholastics? We're going to get to that in just a minute, but the point of this discussion is that there is no reason to think that it's just natural, it's just to be expected that churchmen are going to speak like leftists when they talk about the economy. That is certainly not to be expected, because we have, to the contrary, the tradition of the late scholastics, which basically nobody knew about until the 20th century, and largely until Alex's work really drew out just how free market these important theologians were. So very important stuff. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Let's welcome Alex to the program right now. Alex, thanks for being here.
Welcome. It's very pleased to be with you, Tom. I always admire your academic work.
Well, likewise, I am looking at my review of your book, Faith and Liberty, which in turn is a revision of your book from 1986, Christians for Freedom, Late Scholastic Economics. And the review is so glowing, like I'm almost embarrassed by how glowing it is, but I was so thrilled by this book, Faith and Liberty, when I first read it years ago, that to have the chance to review it and give you proper thanks was an opportunity I jumped at. Let's start off by having you explain who the late scholastics were. This is a term that's probably not familiar to the layman.
Yeah, in a way it means the late scholars, or great professors that follow Aquinas usually are labeled, you know, the late scholastics. Even Aquinas, sometimes it's mentioned from group with them, but usually it's mentioned, you know, it's hard to define perfectly, but the people, the scholars, mostly moralists and priests, you know, and jurists who taught after St. Thomas and after, and not only after St. Thomas and the two or three centuries after it, but from, I would say, from the 13th to the early 17th century, you know, that long period is sometimes labeled the late scholastics.
Now, up until, well, probably the 20th century, I suppose, with Raymond de Ruiver and some other scholars, people had the wrong impression, by and large, about what the scholastics believed about economics. What was that faulty impression that then, thanks to you and to others, was eventually overturned?
Well, I had the same impression. I was brought up in a way that everything before the French Revolution was bad. Everything that was before was like the Dark Ages. And the major topic that was discussed about the medieval economics was their theory of just price, that they have a fixed notion of wealth, a fixed notion of the economy, that the expert would define the just price and the just wage, and that idea of a society determined from up down, you know, dominated their economic view. And when I discovered that this was not only a little bit wrong, but completely wrong, I basically changed course in my career and in my outlook to philosophy, to history, and I learned a tremendous amount just by reading this great moralist, not only in economics, but in other fields of human action.
I think one of the reasons that there had been such poor scholarship or sometimes no scholarship on this period is that a lot of these late scholastics are writing not in treatises whose titles would give you the idea that they're talking about economics, but they would bury discussions of economic topics somewhere in the middle of dense moral treatises that were also written in Latin. And modern writers are not interested in these moral treatises, and they're certainly not able to read in Latin, so they had two strikes against them. And therefore, people were able to people wound up just repeating what they believed to be in there. And for instance, I think what most people believed was that these scholars believed that there was an objectively identifiable just price that we could identify for each good, and then if somebody were to sell above that just price, he would be engaging in immoral behavior. Now, what in fact did they believe about price? Is there anything to this idea that they believed in a just price? And if so, what did they mean by that term?
Well, their analysis equated just price with market prices devoid of fraud, monopoly, or coercion. Some of them said, look, it would be good if we could determine, you know, a just price and know exactly what the price will be. But this varies according to the circumstances about demand, supply. They use a word, common estimation. That was the estimation that takes place in the market. It's not just one buyer and one seller that determines prices, you know, but basically it's the whole market, the market process. So, but they used that name, term, just price, and perhaps that led to some confusion. There are other things as well, I think. In the conclusion of my book, when I try to ask my same questions, how come this happened, you know, that this centuries of contributions were so badly interpreted. And I partly it's political. I said after the French Revolution, committed so many injustices, many people in the church sort of rejected everything that came from reason and looked like, you know, liberal, you know, in the proper sense of the word. And on the other hand, a lot of the enemies of the church, without reason, rejected faith, almost like reason could explain everything. So that combined effect made the few people were looking into this. Three major sources, I think, that helped change my mind. I read a contribution by Joseph Schumpeter, the great Austrian historian of thought. Then F.A. Hayek wrote a little bit about them because he was influenced by one of his pupils, Marjorie Grice Hutcheson, who started first the monetary theory of his authors. And then the great Austrian scholar Murray Rothbard also spoke very well about them. But it was only when I went to Europe and I went to the libraries and I saw that this were not one, two, three, or four authors. This was what's called common doctrine at the time. They had some flaws, you know, they were more pro-free market, private property. No, they are not libertarians in the modern, you know, quasi-anarcho-capitalist state. Anarcho-capitalist definition. But they were at the forefront of the defense of an order of economics based on private property and freedom of contract. And I think they have no doubt about it.
I'm aware that Hayek thought very highly of Rothbard's essay on a new light on the prehistory of the Austrian school, in which he spends quite a bit of time talking about the late scholastics. So it was in the 20th century that finally these prejudices began to wither away. So it's interesting the way you put it. There were two prejudices at once. You had prejudice against faith, which meant what could we possibly learn from the late scholastics, so let's not even look. And then, this is a phenomenon that I've encountered with many people, you had a reactionary aspect in the church that their view was that anything that had anything whatsoever to do with modernity was ipso facto tainted. And so the free market or anything that involved that sort of approach to the social sciences must be wrong, must be disparaged. And so they might consider the late scholastics, but they would have an interest in distorting them or suppressing their real message. Now, tell us about, we'll get into some basic ideas in a minute about wages and profits and things like that, but I'm interested in the subject of distributive versus commutative justice. Can you explain what these two concepts are and what the late scholastics had to say about them?
Well, this is a huge topic. Commutative justice comes from the word commutations, which is basically, you know, justice that takes place mostly with contracts, with changes, between private property parties. Distributive justice is a term that was used, you know, starting from Aristotle onward until at least a couple of centuries ago, which is the justice that has to do with all the things that we have in common. Has nothing to do with taking from one person and giving to the other. It has to do, you know, how do we distribute government position, how we allocate taxes. Now, they specifically Medex said that wages, profits, rents have nothing to do with distributive justice. You know, these are not the topics that have to do with distributive justice. Unfortunately, toward the end of the 19th century and beginning of the 20th, the whole school of thought started to equate distributive justice with taking property from one and giving it to the other, mostly taking from the rich and productive and giving to the unproductive. This, I did not find a single author in several centuries of contribution who had that notion of distributive justice, which I think is very negative and exists today and is prevalent in many circles of the church and other moralist, discussions.
My view is that sometimes when I'm told that I'm not allowed to hold these views, if I'm a member of the church, I've got to defer to this or that person or this or that document. But the day that the late scholastics are condemned as heretics is the day that I'll listen to those people. But until then, I persist in my views. Now, what did they think about wages? Of course, we know that a lot of times when we read popular renditions of Catholic social thought, the idea is that a living wage must be paid that will allow the laborer and his family to live in reasonable comfort. What was the late scholastic view?
Well, no, that they would have loved that, but basically they believe that the wages needed to be determined like any other price. And if you want to help the worker, you should help them, you know, with charity and with other efforts. So, again, you don't treat the worker as you treat, you know, your typewriter or any other capital good. You know, human beings have a special dignity, and they always, you know, spoke about that. But especially, you know, those authors were even explicitly that the just wage was not defined as what is sufficient for his sustenance and much less for the maintenance of his children and family. This I'm quoting, you know, directly a Jesuit, you know, also from this, like our current Pope, you know, Pope Francis Jesuit. This is a quote from Luis de Molina, one of the great Jesuit theologians. And again, he was not condemned as a heretic. You know?
That's right. That's right. And I have that quotation right here. He says that the employer, then the quotation is only obliged to pay the laborer the just wage for his services, considering all the attendant circumstances, not what is sufficient for his sustenance, and much less for the maintenance of his children and family. Then we have Domingo de Soto, also a 16th century figure, saying, if they freely accepted this salary for their job, it must be just. No injury is done to those who gave their consent. And then he says very bluntly, if you do not want to serve for that salary, leave. Yes. Well, this is quite shocking to modern ears.
For sure. And again, he's a Dominican, and I want to stress that because some people say, well, the Jesuits have so much freedom of thought, they can say anything. No, this is Franciscans saying, you know, who lived just a few centuries after St. Francis, saying exactly the same thing. And so I don't think they were cruel, you know, they were just describing the economic system as it is. And again, many of them, the Soto has a whole little book, you know, how to help the poor and what things to do, what things not to do to help them. They were, so again, they were very serious scholars, and I think it would be great for the hierarchy and members of this religious orders today to go back and read these authors.
Now, it's true that when we look at your book, Faith and Liberty, we can clearly see that there is a sympathy for a free market economy. In other words, one in which prices and wages are determined in the way that we are accustomed to seeing them determined, not by political authorities, but by the give and take in the marketplace. But there's more here to the late scholastics. There's also some theoretical advances. For example, in value theory, their value theory seems to anticipate, if not themselves fully articulate, subjective value theory that we associate with the Austrians.
Correct. There was one author, Duns Scotus, the famous Scottish author, who basically, not because he was against the market, just the opposite. He said, well, the businessmen are so important that the prince should see that the entrepreneur, the businessman, gets compensated for his cost, almost like a cost plus determination of profit. It all came and attacked him, saying no, a businessman is entitled to his profit if he anticipates the market correctly. St. Bernardine of Siena, great Franciscan, the 14th century, basically said, no, look, if he anticipates the market correctly and earns 300%, he's entitled to that just profit. There's not a profit determined by the prince above cost that is just. If that would be the case, they say only the rich would always have money, because no matter what they do, they will have add a little percentage, and get a just small profit, but they all attack. Scotus was the only one who had that view, and because he the efforts of the businessmen and the industrialists, and were so important.
Yeah, I've got here from a passage from Luis Saravia de la Calle, who said that he makes the interesting point that, as I think you were getting at just now, if we had to consider labor and risk in order to assess the just price, no merchant would ever suffer loss. So actually, to think this way is actually to privilege people with wealth and privilege people who are already established in the market to say that there is some kind of just profit that we calculate on the basis of risk or on the basis of the good itself. Well, then who would ever make losses? Everybody would be obligated to be paid the so-called just price. There would be no losses. What about monetary theory? You've got in here a chapter on the theory of money. What kind of contributions are the late scholastics making there?
Well, they were the greatest champions of sound money. It was clear, at the time we had the gold standard. That was a system that evolved through ages because it proved, was most respectful, of having a money that helps as a unit of account and is the most widely used means of exchange. So whenever they had to criticize someone for the increase in prices, they criticized the monetary authority, and especially one, again, another Jesuit writing in 1609, he basically anticipated many of the great contributions that Austrians and Chicago economists made about the dangers of inflation. But let me go one step back to what you said before about the distributive justice and helping the poor, and supposedly by fixing profits, of the rich. It's those systems, economies that have those systems where the poor do the worst. Because, as you say, the people, businessmen get less entrepreneurial, and the economy is not dynamic, and it's harder for the poor people, to rise to the top because they are limited to the profits they can make. And again, the economy gets very stratified. Going back to your monetary contribution, they thought that the money that is stolen by government manipulation, it was like the worst type of thievery, because when a thief gets into your stable and steals your horse or part of your grain, you see it, but through monetary manipulation, people don't see sometimes, who the real culprit is. So they were very strict in that as well.
Why do you think, bringing this closer to the present day, why do you think it is that members of the church hierarchy, especially in Latin America, tend to be so unsound on economics? The usual answer is that their own experience has either been with statism or with state capitalism, or situations in which state-run institutions are then more or less handed over to cronies, and they confuse this with capitalism. Now, I can understand that, but is it really too much to ask for people to be able to make distinctions between the system they're living under and the dictionary definition of what a free market is supposed to be?
I think it is difficult, you know, because, again, many of these bishops, and the current pope is a good example. You know, again, they have friends, you know, who are economists, and I know a Chicago boy, you know, who has spent time with them, you know, but he doesn't read those books, you know, but they see what happens in their country. They listen to confessions. Confession is secret, but they realize, you know, the enormous power of what people call today crony capitalism, you know, the owners of wealth, old and new, who get close to the state to get privileges. And I think that combined effect that they have not been exposed to what we both would call good economics, and the second, that the practice that they see is so flawed, and the great champions of capitalism, you know, multinationals, you know, are caught bribing left and right. So this is, you know, what they see. And so when they listen to free market or libertarians answer with two simplistic words everything, say, oh, it's the government fault, the free market will solve it. When you criticize a capitalist at something bad and you say, oh, no, he's not a capitalist, then they say, hey, this is a religion. This is not a free market philosophy. So this absolutist view of the free market is something, you know, that has to be condemned. It's another sort of, you know, creating a God that doesn't exist. So a good professor of mine in Catholic University in Argentina basically said, look, don't be so harsh with the bishops. You know, if economists do not know economics, why do you expect the bishops to know better economics? You have people like Paul Krugman, Stiglitz, and others saying things, you know, that are, for you and me, are crazy. But the bishops listen to them.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, Alex. I've said exactly the same thing to people, that as exasperating as I can sometimes find it, arguing with people in the church on subjects like this, at the same time, you're right. If the economists don't know economics, how can I be losing my patience with people who, you know, who have other things to do during the day, who aren't professionals, who really ought to know better? I wonder if I can close by asking you about what you're working on these days. You mentioned to me privately, and here I am disclosing it in public, but that you were doing a little something on what these men thought about questions involving the natural environment, and this is increasingly relevant because we know the Pope is apparently working on a document related to that subject. What have you come up with?
Correct. And I just asked about it because I wrote a short paper, 10-page paper for the Catholic University of Argentina. So it's a bigger chance that he might read it. The key problem that we find today, that is a very mistaken anthropology, the view of about who the human person is, unfortunately, has drifted towards the view of the human person as a collection of chemicals that click in, click out, sometimes used as a mere individual. And for these people, the humans, you know, this modalist from Aquinas, you know, and all his followers, and the human being was at the center of creation and had basically, you know, power to have domain, you know, over not only over the fish, you know, and the waters, but even of the stars. And so each problem that I was able to study where they address an environmental issue, being, you know, forest, you know, St. Boniface, writing in the 7th century, cut down an oak that was revered as a god, you know, and thanks to that, he was able to convert a lot of pagan Europe. But from bullfighting, you know, which, again, there were some debates, and for a while it was condemned, but never there was concern for the bull. You know, it was the concern for the human being heart. You know, there can be cruelty and enjoying over things that we should not enjoy. But when they address the topic, you know, of forest, their concern basically was respect of private property and have proper handling of the resources. But even St. Francis, you know, the people who was, again, he's the only person who I think, you know, had a slightly different perspective, because he even spoke to the animals, according to the to narratives. And they asked him, you know, are you allowed to eat meat on Fridays, if on Christmas, if Christmas falls on a Friday? And he said, look, on Christmas Day, even the walls should be able to eat meat. And he never punished people who went hunting, even for pleasure, you know. But overall, I did not find a single circumstances where the late scholastic medieval scholars will side with what today environmentalists argue, you know, that almost equate nature and the rights of nature with the rights of human beings. So from mining to fishing to hunting to bullfighting, in all those topics, you know, the late scholastics, you know, argued the same as a free market economist would argue today. And when there was an effort or spillover effect, like too much burning of coal in cities in England, they said, well, no, look, this is damaging other people. There should be a regulation that prevents this.
Well, I'd love to see that article get a wider audience than it may get in an academic journal in Argentina. I hope there'll be a chance to publish maybe a popular version of it somewhere online. Do you think?
George, that yes, I hope so, you know. But and again, I think that people like you and other economists who engage the church in a respectful manner and basically say, look, you know, this is a topic, economics, you know, economic science, that belongs to the layman. But many times the Vatican and the bishops say that, oh, look, these are topics that belong to the layman. But then they gave their opinion. They give their opinion with a lot of authority, that almost, you know, they're acting like economists. And my hope is that the debate about what is sound economics will be between you and Paul Krugman.
Thank you.
Two bishops, yeah.
Thank you, thank you. Before I let you go, I wonder, do you want to take a minute to tell people about the Atlas Economic Research Foundation? I bet a lot of my listeners are not familiar with it.
Well, things don't happen by chance in life. You know, things I say happen because of ideas, because of incentives, because of leadership, and also of providence or luck. And to work in ideas, I think you have to be professional and use the best methods of business. And we think that intellectual entrepreneurs, people like you, if work, you know, with think tanks, with university-based centers, using the best possible practices, you know, they will be more effective in trying to disseminate the right views that will allow, you know, people to flourish, you know, in a climate of freedom, respectful of the dignity of the human persons. What Atlas does is try to support these intellectual entrepreneurs through training programs, sometimes through grants, through networking efforts. So it was started by an Englishman in 1981 who started a think tank in England in the 50s that saw the decline of England, you know, and led to the changes that Margaret Thatcher initiated and later were continued. So Atlas doesn't accept any government money. We are sort of content philosophically, and I think, you know, it's an outstanding organization, and hopefully some people will try to look what we do in our website. That is atlasnetwork.org.
Okay, atlasnetwork.org is the website, and the book is Faith and Liberty, The Economic Thought of the Late Scholastics by Alejandro Chafuen. And I appreciate your time today, Alex. As I say, this book was very, very important to me. I have cherished this book over the years. Thanks for your ongoing work in this important cause.
Thank you so much, Tom, and continue also to write so well as you always do.
All right, everybody, that's the show for today. Let's see what's coming up next week. Actually, before I do that, let me make a mental note to myself. I got to have Kevin Gutzman back on. I got to schedule him. He's just finishing up his course for us on the American Revolution, in which he's showing that the American Revolution was not just about no taxation without representation. I mean, what a stupid thing to fight about. I want to be looted by these people, not by those people. I mean, it was about something a little bit more important than that. So Kevin's going to be covering that in a new course for LibertyClassroom.com where all the cool people are and where you guys can get a big, big, big-time discount if you use coupon code DISCOUNT in all caps over at LibertyClassroom.com. 9, soon-to-be 10 courses. I just talked to Professor Jared Casey. His History of Political Thought Part 2 is coming along very well. We'll have that in about a month. I'm going to maybe make transcripts out of that whole course, History of Political Thought from the Ancient World up to the Present, by Professor Casey, and release that as an ebook. Give that out maybe to my supporting listeners here on the show. You can become a supporting listener at supportinglisteners.com. You can join Liberty Classroom at libertyclassroom.com. All right, let's see what's going on next week. Next week, I'm going to have Tim Ravitch on. He's a lawyer who deals in questions, for example, involving drones, but in particular involving private drones. Like, for instance, if Amazon is going to really launch, so to speak, this new program where it can send a little flying robot to give you your package, what are the legal ramifications of this? So we're going to talk about that. Lou Rockwell will join us once again. We didn't quite get to the end of his book. I want to finish up our discussion with Lou about his great new book, Against the State, an Anarcho-Capitalist Manifesto. So Lou Rockwell returns. Then Bob Murphy returns to finish up our coverage of his book, Chaos Theory. We're going to grill him on this vexed question of defense. Then Anthony Gregory comes back to the program to talk to us about George W. Bush, the presidency of George W. Bush, a retrospective, because sometimes you see people saying, oh gosh, I miss George W. Bush. Oh my gosh, what is wrong with you people? What is wrong? So anyway, we got Anthony coming back, and then I'm talking to Steve Dace. You guys remember him? He's an Iowa radio host, very, very popular. Got a huge listenership in Iowa, and I was just pulling my hair out over this guy. Remember, I made some of you have been following me for a while, I made a video just for him. Steve Dace endorse Ron Paul, and at least he didn't endorse Santorum. We can give him that. He wound up endorsing Gingrich, and I think I made another video or a blog post saying, my gosh, man, are you just stabbing me in the heart? Like, why are you doing this here? But he had me on after he had somebody from the Ron Paul campaign, which, you know, was keep to say they were keeping me at arm's length was Jesse Benton and the whole crew is an understatement. So I was trying to help Ron in my own way. I was making videos and I was getting hundreds of thousands of views on them and promoting him the best I could without the official campaign. I was going to help him whether they wanted the help or not. So I was doing that. And meanwhile, Dace had been saying, look, if somebody wants to come on my show and make the case for Ron Paul, make the case to evangelical Christians, then I welcome them. Well, I'm not going to give the name of who it was, but the official campaign sent somebody over, and Dace ate him for lunch. So then I said, well, look, I'll do it. Like, again, this is the sort of thing I would have done for free. They wouldn't have even need to pay me. Forget these five-figure monthly retainers. You wouldn't have had to pay me anything. So I went on and made the case. You can actually find it on YouTube. I made the case, the Ron Paul case. Now, I'm not an evangelical Christian, but I can make the Ron Paul case to just about anybody. You can find it on YouTube, the episode of the Steve Dace Show where I'm talking to him about this, and he's very respectful toward me because we've had a good relationship even though we disagree on some important things. You can still be friends with people you disagree with. So I'm having Steve on. We're going to hash this whole thing out. He's got a new book out. We're going to talk about that. So this is going to be an interesting week coming up. If you're enjoying the show, support us at supportinglisteners.com or remember us when you're about to make that Amazon purchase by heading over to tomwoodsradio.com and entering from there. All right, that's it, everybody. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
The Tom Woods Show.